Do it again.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world.
You're listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.
Hey girl, a martini, shaken, not stirred.
Don't try and church it up, son.
You can't handle the truth.
I am big. The picture that got small.
Your first one's on us.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling. I'm your host, Mark Rigadonna, and with me, as always,
Richie Byrne.
It's great to see you, Richie.
Look at you with the glasses on today.
Got on my spectacles.
What's going on, y'all right?
I'm good, man. I actually worked out. I did an old workout from when I played football in high school. Workout, upper body and abs.
Do it with your eyelids? Like, why do you need glasses?
No, I'm sore as shit, so I can barely read the screen.
Oh, okay.
Joel asked me, he goes, it's a good sore, right? And I go, there's a no good sore for me. It's hurting and not hurting. Those are my two on. How's it going with
Friday,
you?
Brother.
It's Friday. Mother's Day weekend's coming
Mother's
up.
Day? Did you get your mom anything? Because I didn't.
I can't go shopping.
Could have sent her a card.
Yeah. I'll call her.
Could have done a lot of things.
Yeah. I probably could have went into a real profession and made them proud.
Could have made them proud.
But I didn't do that.
That shit has sailed. That shit has sailed out. This is episode 96, bro.
Oh, we're getting there.
And we have a returning guest. We have
a returning guest.
First season.
I'm super excited to have him here. Should we just bring him right out?
Yeah, we don't have anything today. Let's just get him.
We don't got nothing to say. All right, folks, we got a great one coming up. Very funny guy.
Friday. Let him do all the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Folks, he's in good shape. He can do the lifting. Yeah, folks, Kevin Flynn's here.
Kevin Flynn
is in the house.
Hey, guys, look at you. Just checking you guys out from this angle. It's like, Rick Adana looks like Elvis Costello on steroids, and you look like a biker from Dublin, for God's sakes. Somebody's angel. I'm a fucking hell's angel.
Somebody the other day said that Richie looks like if Hulk Hogan didn't get into wrestling.
It was Anthony Rodia.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. That's a comic. Giving another comic his props on the line.
I love it.
My hair's getting long, Flinny.
Look at that, man. You know, and your roots, such nice brown hair. Why do you dye the roots gray? That's weird.
Well, I don't know. It's a good look. It
looking
makes
good,
me
man.
Distinguished, Flinny. Makes me look distinguished.
You actually do look thin. You lost some weight, Richie, huh?
No, I really haven't.
That's the black shirt. You've gained weight? Jesus. This is the thing with not working. It throws everybody off with their schedules.
I usually gain weight in my face, but for some reason I must have not gained weight in my face because you're not the first. Everyone's going, wow, you look good. And I'm like, I guess from here up, I'm doing good. But believe me, anything below is...
You're doing Rick Adonis eyelid workout. That's what you're doing.
They say black is slimming. When I close my eyes, I'm thin.
Exactly, because you blacked out. That's it.
Yeah, which isn't a stretch.
So, Kevin, we got it for any of our viewers who maybe don't know you. We have a little stand-up comedy clip we would like to play of yours. So we'll play that now.
All right, God bless him. You know, I'm a grandchild of immigrants. I'm like, wow, driving a cab in New York City 2 weeks from Haiti. My God, that's awesome. You know, and then I'm thinking, like, it's snowing. I'm like, it's gotta be the first time this guy's ever seen snow. And just as I make that connection, sure enough, we get through like the second light, the car goes. Car spins out, slams up against the curb, stalls. Guy looks and goes, I no fucking drive. I go, I gotta get to another show, I'll drive. He goes, okay. So I get in the front seat, he gets in the back, meter's running, I drive to another comedy club, I get out, I pull up at the other club, the door opens up, I get out of the front, he gets out of the back, I pay him, and he drives away. And all the other comedians are standing there, they're like, what the fuck was that? I go, that, my friends, is America. That's good.
Dude, I've seen that clip. I don't know how many times. Still laugh every single time.
My God, that's an oldie, man. I love it. Do you guys have that problem? Like, I was thinking, if I had to go up right now tonight, I'd have to really think about it, how to do that bit again. You know, I did it for 3 years in a row, maybe. You know, it should be a muscle memory, but you gotta get out of a rhythm a little bit.
It's a child walking.
There's a drunk child walking through the room.
Exactly. Daddy, the nanny's touching me. Help!
Now, Kev, when was the last time you performed?
Boy, I tell you, I think I did a corporate event in Naples. I can look at my computer, but I tell you, I was supposed to be in Florida for a good 2.5 weeks, and I had work in Palm Beach and kind of a couple of country clubs, a corporate event, and then I had Captain Dan's, I think it was in Naples, Florida. Sold out. Show.
I was there, and I had all the staff ready to play a joke on you and Jackie.
Oh, did you?
And you guys ended up not going.
Well, sold out, man, and we stayed there the whole week waiting for the show. And then the night before, he had no choice; he had to cancel because the health department something. So what is that? That's in March, and then my God, my March. I load up March and April like I'm on the road constantly because in like June, I start to, you know, get ready for the comedy festival on Nantucket. And so my time is all there. So I took a big hit. All of us did. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
My point is, the last time I got on stage was a guest spot at Governor's on Sunday, March 15th. And I have not thought about my act since Sunday, March 15th. You know what I mean?
It's good, though. I mean, I'm trying to look at it like I'm going to try to go up with a new half at least, you know, just because we get bored. What happens is, Richie, once you get to your level, at Mark's level, you sort of get to the point where, like, you're almost performing for yourself in a way. I think that's where the great ones go, I think, because you look at, like, to say, look, all of us here can do an hour. I can do an hour and I make people laugh. They'll say, oh, you were great. You're really funny. And after a while, that's not enough. We've done it for years and years. What has to happen after that is you have to say, these are the things I really feel passionate about. I really feel good about, and I really want to talk about, and make them laugh like you did with your other hour.
Right.
And then I think you hit the next level. And so I think that this could be an opportunity for people to really kind of break it down again, almost like we were open micers and say, all right, what can I write? What can I do? What do I want to talk about?
You're right. But my other concern is when we go back, we're all going to have to do coronavirus jokes. And the problem is if we don't do them, people are going to go, why didn't they talk about the virus? But if we do them, they're going to be like, is everyone going to talk about the virus? You know what I mean?
I think it's the MC's responsibility, and I'm hoping I don't have to.
You know, look, I worked with years ago, Jack Gallagher. He was the first comic that I ever saw do this, where I was featuring for him in Boston. I was a young guy, and he watched my whole set. And I was like, hey, thanks for watching my set. He's a really nice guy. And he's like, oh, that was great. This was good. This is good. I said, yeah, you know, usually headliners don't watch the other person's set. He goes, oh, no, you always watch the other two act sets on the first night. So you know that you don't step on other material because, you know, you can, but I think with the coronavirus jokes, it's going to be like all you have to do is walk up and go, hey, you've already heard all the coronavirus stuff. I'm not going there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, as long as you acknowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, or like even if you're doing a bit about a cruise ship or something, say, remember those?
My God, the cruise ships. Oh, my goodness. I'm glad I'm off those things. But I think a couple of comics still on them. They deserve it. They're out there. They're out there drifting.
What's her name? Tom Cotter was telling us when he was on the show that I can't think of her name. I know that's a shock, Mark.
Michelle Ballin?
Michelle Ballin got stuck on a ship.
Yeah, she was out there for weeks.
And got paid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Tom said she was getting paid every week.
Yeah, why couldn't I have gotten stuck?
She got paid by the crew. She was hooking. It was a different kind of pay. All those Greek officers, man. They used to have Greek guys. They used to be Greek guys on Celebrity and Royal Caribbean, and they were the biggest assholes. Can we swear in this show?
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah.
You just can't say Greek, but.
Greek style. You ever hear the joke or the Irish girl's getting married. And
see, I'm glad he remembered that we start with a joke because we forgot.
So the this Irish girl's getting married, and her mother takes her aside before she's getting married. She's marrying a Greek guy. And she says, now, Bridget, be careful now. The Greeks, they do it a little differently, if you know what I mean. They do it a little differently. She says, what do you mean, Mama? She says, oh, don't you worry. One night, when you're in the making coitus, making love in the bed, he'll try to do something a little different. And you just say, oh, I'm not that type of girl. She's like, okay, Mama. So a couple of weeks go by. They're having sex every night. Finally, one day the Greek guy goes, okay, I want you to roll over. She goes, ah, I'm not that kind of girl. He goes, okay, I thought you might want to have kids. You know, because they were every night having, you know, the wrong way. What game can't the Greeks play? Leapfrog, because they never get past the first jump. That's it.
All right, well, you got the jokes out of the way there, Flynn.
Right, I didn't know where I haven't told those in 20 years, but those are my old man's jokes.
It looks like you're both drinking something brown. Yeah. What do you guys got?
Give me a minute to think of it. It's Bird Dog.
That's really good delicious stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a very select bottle. My girlfriend got it for me. So she, nice. Very nice. Yeah.
I'm doing the Johnny Black.
Oh, Johnny Black. The Richie go-to, Johnny Black.
It's called Johnny African American now. So
Johnny African American.
don't be throwing that around.
I'm going very un-Ricadana. I'm doing a sparkling water with CBD in it.
Does that count, Richie? He'd be thrown out of the Irish club, I think, if there was.
What's the CBD? Is that going to fuck you up a little bit, maybe?
Yeah, it's supposed to mellow you down.
He's sore.
One of my best friends is in recovery. And he goes to these tea places.
Oh, we went to it.
You know him, yeah. And Tim Sullivan, I can say his name. And one night, I was meeting him, and he goes to these tea places where you order tea, and it fucks you up, Kev. And
yeah, it's a CBD THC.
It's got like the whatever in it, whatever's legal now.
You just sounded so old, Richie. It's got the whatever in it.
Whatever.
You know, it's got the marijuana.
You know what the kids are
doing. You don't have to smoke the jazz cigarettes anymore. You can just drink the teas.
It's got the pot.
They hopped up on goofballs and Christ knows what all.
So I go meet him, and he's got this big cup. And he says, dude, it was $25. And I drink one, and I'm like completely mellowed out, right? But I have a show that night in the city, so I don't want to get too fucked up. So he orders another one, and Joel meets us. Because I'm going to have to. So I'm going to have a meeting with my buddy Tim, and then a meeting with Joel.
Joel met you. What was it, old ladies' night there? Old ladies get in free. Hey,
Joel,
how you doing?
Joel ends up drinking two of these teas.
My God.
And Tim had two. So now we go out to have like a meeting. We're at dinner. And I look up and the two of them are like this. We're going to get nothing done. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They're like. And Tim's going, nah, it's all legal. It's all legal. I'm like, great. I'm glad it's legal. You guys are fucking stoned out of your mind.
Exactly. Try getting something done. It's legal.
Yeah.
You guys drink two of those, and then we should have a meeting. That way we can all be on the same wave, man.
I did it. I'm not a pot guy. Like, I would just always get insecure. Like, I think something was hanging off my nose, or my eye was getting screwed up. I couldn't look at a girl at a party or whatever. So I was trying to stay sober. But I've been eating the gummies at night to sleep, and it's helping me. Yeah, quite a bit. But one night I did a play this summer, and after the play – I didn't want to drink, and I just ate two gummies instead of one. And then I went out instead of going home, which I thought I was going home. And I sat at the bar, and I was just like, chilling. You guys, you want to order a drink? No. Flynn, I've never seen you not order a drink before. Yeah, whatever, man. It was a good feeling, though.
Where did you get the gummies? Were they legal? Were they like one of the
No, they're at California. In California. And I was on Nantucket, so.
I got you.
But they are. They're anti-inflammatories, so it helps with joint stuff. Mark was talking before we got on air about being hurt from lifting. It helps with anti-inflammatory.
Really?
And then the THC, they say the THC, you try to get one
makes
that's
you 10 cooler.
10 to yeah, exactly. But then you got to get a van with carpeting inside too. But they, I guess with the THC CBD mix, you kind of do like an 8 or 10 to 1 and it's good for sleeping. So I'm hoping that, you know.
Yeah.
Because
I need something. I haven't been sleeping this whole quarantine. I've been having like horrible, and also having two kids who hate sleeping makes it even worse.
I think that's the biggest thing. Because someone said to me, Richie, do you have any kids?
No.
Oh, that's no. You're gay. I mean, I don't. Nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying, no. I don't.
And we're allowed to adopt. I just
decided. You are. Anderson Cooper adopted a kid this past week, so there's hope for you anyway. But they say once you
the Greeks.
I'm hitting it all, everybody, every angle.
It's our last show. We almost made it to 100, Mark.
Got thrown out. The Greek government interjected and took everything away.
You don't want Greeks interjecting either.
Exactly. You don't want that. But I forget what I was saying, what we were talking about.
Kids.
Oh, kids. They say once you have kids, your memory goes. No, they say once you have kids, you never sleep the same again. You just. Yeah.
I think it was 16. Martin Mull. Martin Mull has the greatest quote was having kids is like installing a bowling alley in your head.
He was good. I didn't get him when I was young, but he's so dry.
What was the show he had where it was like a talk show? Good Morning Fernwood.
Good evening. Fernwood Tonight, I think.
Fernwood Tonight.
Which was an offshoot of Mary Hartman.
Yeah. So I thought it was actually a legitimate Ohio show because it takes place in Fernwood, Ohio.
Yeah.
And he's Canadian. He's a Canadian. So
later when people would talk about it, I'm like, you guys got that show? I thought that was like an Ohio.
I think Mary Hartman, which Louise Lasser, I think that was a show she would watch. And he was on, like, she'd watch the show. And then they took that show and turned it into its own show.
Are you smoking pot now?
No, I'm serious.
Show, and then you had
she had it like it was a TV show, and one of the things she watched on her TV show was that, and they would cut to him.
Wasn't she married to Woody Allen?
Woody Allen, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
What happened to him? Where's he at now?
I think he plays a fiddle or a flute.
Look, none of us will say anything. Just hoping we'll get in one of his movies one day. Jade,
you'll make fun of the gays and the Greeks, but not Woody Allen, baby.
No, I'm not making fun of the gays. I was making fun of you. Big difference.
Making fun of one of them.
They wouldn't have you. You'd get thrown out of that club.
Oh. In a minute, in a heart.
who's the biker from Dublin?
Everybody's like, why does he not do anything?
The morning of my wedding, I'm driving around in a convertible. It's a Chrysler Sebring. It's gold with a black convertible leather, all that shit, with Marshall Chiles. And I'm picking up the dog from the groomer for the wedding. And Marshall goes, you know, everybody thinks we're the ugliest gay couple in New York City right now.
Yeah, It's tough to compete. I used to say in L.A., all these good-looking guys, I would say anybody better looking than me is gay. And there's a lot of fags out there. Lots of them.
Oh, come on. We saw the cover of your TV extra.
Oh, yeah. How was that, huh? Oh, yeah, there it is. Look at that.
There he is. Most handsome man in comedy.
That was you? No, go back to it.
Yeah. Where'd you get that short sleeve black shirt?
I got it from Richie. It's one of Richie's.
You were talking about Nantucket. Richie, Joel, and I got to come out and join you. And we have a picture from that night.
What a great weekend.
Yeah. Oh, that's a very famous doctor right up front there with Joel.
Yeah.
Dr. Tina Alster is her name.
Yes.
And she is the dermatologist to the stars. And there, look at me. Jeez. I think I'm in the Greek club there. Look at me. Looking little.
We all look like we were superimposed into that photo.
We had a blast that night, didn't we? We had
a lot of fun. Such a good night.
Good dinner and good cocktails. Oh, great. You guys were there in the winter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the food was ridiculous, man.
Yeah, and then you guys
were in the winter. It was because I was watching the
spring.
Horse race.
It was spring.
Yeah, it was I think the Kentucky Derby was that weekend. So it had to be. I remember going to watch the horse race.
You guys had a great meal, and then I had to drop you off at Stop and Shop because you washed it all down with a quart of ice cream, each of you. And it's legendary because I say I had the three of you in the car, and you're like, "Hey, we're gonna get some ice cream." I'm like, "Okay." I'm thinking I'm gonna get a quart of chocolate ice cream or something. We'll come out. We'll all have scoop back at home. You each come out with your own quart.
Yeah, but in all fairness,
there's nothing left.
Mark and I shared a quart, and Joel had the other two.
You guys were focused. I got to give you that. It's amazing.
Mark and I were.
Tell us a little bit about the festival. Fill us in a little on.
It actually started. You know, it's. I wouldn't say it's a sad story, but it basically, Nantucket is a very interesting place. It's very wealthy. You always hear about the well-to-do, the one percenters that go out there. But in the rest of the year, there's the working class that are out there, and I'm a working class kid. And you know, when I first started going out there, I was playing soccer. And with soccer, you meet all types. You know, I learned about the world from the game of soccer. But out there, I'm playing on soccer teams with the Jamaicans, the Irish, the English, the Scottish, Norwegians, all these guys. So they were all the guys who actually worked everywhere. And so I'd get the scoop on everybody. You know, but I also know all the, I knew all the sort of people involved in the arts and everything else too. So I knew kind of the whole gamut out there. And the year, one of the years my daughter, I think she was about 2 years old, we moved out to Nantucket because my stepdaughter was in between schools. So I was out there in the off season. And so I worked with the soccer team a little bit. And they were going through a terrible patch of suicides, teen suicides. Wow. And the thing about the island is, it's lifestyles of the rich and famous in the summer. And it doesn't matter if you are a working class kid or whatever, everybody is privy to these great beaches, these great parties, everything. So I was a working class kid and I lived in a summer town. The summer was a little better than the winter. Didn't know why, because we were down at the beach all day and doing stuff. But I think with these kids on Nantucket back then anyway, they'd have this great life and they'd see these huge boats pull up and parties and everybody's going to everything. And then all of a sudden, boom, winter happens. And I think there was a sort of an emotional speedball. Like here's the high of the highs. And then all of a sudden you're in a desolate island all alone out there. And so they had a cluster of suicides. Wow. And the last, one of the last kids that it had happened to, I knew through coaching a little bit. And he was a fan of soccer and a fan of comedy and used to ask me, do you know Lewis Black? Do you know Jim Gaffigan? I'm like, well, yeah, we know these guys. We come up in the business with each other. And when he died, I was, I heard about it. I was in New York City. And about 2 days later, the New York Times came out with an article about this cluster of suicides on Nantucket. And it really kind of hit me. I said, wow, what can I do to sort of maybe help some kids, to sort of let them feel like they have an outlet, they have a voice, they can express themselves. And so I decided to start a festival, a comedy festival out in Nantucket, with it being a nonprofit and being it involved in kids' education. The only idea I had in the beginning was to bring a bunch of my friends out that I knew. We could hang out, have a good time. We could do a couple of workshops for the kids in the day. And they all said yes right away, everybody. And I figured, well, once they're out there, why don't we do a show for the adults at night? And so that's basically how the festival sort of started. It was, do some things for the kids in the day, teach them how to do stand-up comedy, how to express themselves, tell them that because when kids start to talk about stand-up comedy, they start talking about their sisters or their parents or their whatever, and they realize that they all are going through some of the same issues, same problems, same things. And so they feel very empowered. Like they're like, the kids start to come together. They look at each other and go, oh, my mom does that. And my brother does that. It drives me crazy. And so that was really successful. We had 4 workshops the first year and they were completely full, packed to the gills. We didn't turn any of the kids away, way past fire marshal code. They just looked the other way. And, I had some big acts out there, but I also had some people who struggled with certain things. You know, Tom Cotter's got ADD. I have ADD. Jane Condon was dyslexic, you know, so it's sort of like we could talk to these kids who had issues. And then at night, we started to have these big performers kind of do these big shows. And it was, and you know, it's funny. I also educated, I think, in some ways, the donor class that was out in Nantucket, because up until that point, they had sort of looked at comedy as sort of Bud Light and chicken wings. And what they have discovered over the years is that comics are very smart people, you know, present company excluded here, but I'm saying there's a lot of very, very bright people who go up there, and they're not being racist, they're not being sexist, they're not being homophobic like I have been tonight. They're very learned people.
You know what happened, Kevin, before you started the festival, the only comic they knew was you.
Exactly. So they were worried. They were worried. Oh my God! I should say I saw a clip of me doing this at the Boston Comedy Festival, which was this big event that we had. No, the Boston Comedy Riot, this big competition that we had. It was only for 4 years, and I won the finals. Janine Garofalo and I were in the finals, but also in the finals were David Cross, Mark Maron, Tom Cotter, Louis C.K., Nick DiPaolo.
Wow!
And so it was a big deal. But I'm watching myself. I have the kickin' mullet. I should have sent you guys that one. I have the kickin' mullet, and I'm doing, like, you know, the gay figure skater and the dumb basketball player and the dumb football player. So I'm doing all that stuff. Your first 7 minutes is basically still recorded. It's horrible. Right. It's horrible to watch. You know.
Right. But we have a trailer from one of the years at the festival. We'll play that so people can see how awesome your setup is.
Little clack.
Look at that. Oh, quick
yeah.
out, man. Quick
yeah, out. We didn't.
All that was and Lewis Black.
Lewis and Kathleen Madigan. Yeah. Been there. Yeah, yeah. Karen Morgan was there.
That she was at she was up there the time we were up with you.
Yeah, she produced it for a few years with me. Yeah.
Who?
Karen Morgan.
Oh, right.
Really you just funny. Look like a really old guy, Richie. You're like, who? Moving forward.
Time you said I look old, by the way, Kevin Flake.
No, your actions look old, not you.
And one of you also do a really cool one-man show.
Yeah, I just started that. But to go back quickly to the comedy festival, so we're on our 14th year, and it's and after a couple of years, I decided to formalize the teachings that I had done and that others had helped with. And we put together a curriculum called Stand Up and Learn, which is available to the public now. So it's been a great success story, and it all started on Nantucket, and
that's great,
it's been fun. Yeah.
As sad a story as it is, good for you to take that and do something positive with it. You know?
Yeah.
You know, the suicide thing is sad.
And I certainly didn't see the curriculum that would come of it, and that's nationwide now. I didn't see that in the beginning. All I was trying to do is, you know,
just
help my neighborhood.
Gone down since that time, like.
It stopped. It stopped for a bunch of reasons, but one of the main reasons was they had a new principal came, and he really gave this interesting logic. He said they were celebrating the children's lives that had taken their own lives. So you have all the kids go to the auditorium. And you see videos of that kid, you know, playing football or his artwork or pictures that he took or running on the beach. And they were celebrating his death, basically. And I think, you know, the teenage brain is sitting there thinking, oh, I want them to do this for me. Then those bullies would be like really sad. But you don't realize as a kid, it's over, man. It's over if you take your own life. There's no I'll show them. So he said, do not celebrate the death. You immediately send psychiatrists and psychologists over to the family to try and help. You have grief counselors at the school, but you don't have a big, let's celebrate the dude's life or the girl's life. So it was something I had not thought of.
But I wouldn't have.
Yeah. It's counterintuitive.
How many kids do you have, Kevin?
I just have one. Yeah.
You just have one. Okay.
One little girl. Yeah. So little girl is in college. Still call her my little girl. It's the way it works.
Now you had interesting.
That's what's that?
That's what we call Joel, a little girl.
A little girl. Oh my goodness.
Poor he's Joel. All grown up.
He's not here to defend himself.
He's here. He won't come out. He's afraid.
So we were talking about Way One Man, and I appreciate you bringing that up. This Fear of Heights. This means a lot to me. If you can look to the right of that, I think it's the right of everybody's computer or television. Yes. Or what are they watching on? That's my grandfather on the right. They discovered recently.
All the way on the right or in?
All the way on the right, on the other side of the wire.
I thought it was the guy in the white shirt. I was telling the guys earlier.
So it's the guy sitting, he's got a black hat on at the end of it.
And if you look, Richie, you can tell he's one of my relatives because he has a bottle in his left hand. Yeah.
Yes, he does. Oh, cool.
So
it's
I
a Flynn.
First of all, holy shit, dude.
I mean, imagine that. So I was supposed to be a third generation iron worker. I'm looking for a picture here right now, but I was supposed to be a third generation iron worker, and that's what the play's about. Basically, you know, my father drove 2 hours commute each way to have us be raised in Connecticut, and so I it's basically a tribute to my dad and basically the working class that I came from to sort of say, like, I suddenly become a stand-up comic and I have television shows, and I just always had a real, I don't know, what do they call it? Just a weird kind of hang up about, is this really a job? And is this really, you know, does it count as a job, as work? Is it an honest day's labor?
Yeah.
You know,
where in Connecticut did you grow up?
Madison, Connecticut. So.
Madison. And your father went and worked every day in the city?
In the city. And it's 2 hours. So, and he grew up in Brooklyn. And, but that picture, if you look very closely, that hand holding the bottle, that left hand, it has only four fingers. So about 5 years ago, there had always been, it looks like my grandfather. We always thought it was our grandfather, but it had been attributed to a couple people. One, Paddy Flynn, who's my grandfather, or a man named Sonny Glynn, which sounds a lot like Paddy Flynn. But about 5 years ago, a documentary was being made and they found more photos. And the person that they showed different photos of my grandfather, and they showed that he had a finger that wasn't there. And if you can see on this picture here, look at his hand, the left hand holding the hat. See that?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's the same finger. If you look on the, look at that. Oh, you got it close in. There you go. You lost that finger.
Go back to the other one, Joey.
And you can't really go in on that one, but if you can look up close, you can see it's the same finger's gone. So once they saw that, they pretty much said that's the guy. So
because it's such an iconic picture,
right?
That must be mean something to you that you actually have your grandfather's in it.
I know. Well, most people just think you're bullshitting, and how can you prove it? And you can't really prove it other than how I just did. Where people, like, if you look at some newspaper articles, they think it's Paddy Flynn or Sonny Glynn or another guy who's Polish.
The lack of fingerprint to prove it.
I have the lack of fingerprint to prove it. Exactly. So that's about 5 years old anyway. So, so it's a story about basically me, growing up, as you know, my father is an iron worker, works for, he would leave the house at 5:30 in the morning. He'd be back at 6:30, 6:45 at night. And then he couldn't play sports because he had to work as a kid. He had to pay room and board as a kid, which is sort of a throwback from the Great Depression. And so here I am growing up in Lily White, Madison, Connecticut, Republican town, and my father went to the war, Korean War. He, you know, had a Purple Heart, 17 years old. He went to the Korean War. Just an amazing story of giving and sacrificing for others. I find myself in LA, you know, just living single, living in LA, not doing much for anybody other than myself, seemingly. And my father gets lung cancer and I get robbed and on the, you know, pretty much 2-3 days apart. And I start to, I have a bit of a sort of a crisis of confidence or a midlife crisis or whatever, but I really have a very sobering moment for me. And I sort of change the direction of my life at that point.
Wow. Really?
You skipped over a huge chunk, which I love, is I call it the Kevin Flynn mullet pro soccer years.
Yeah.
We'll show. There he is in the middle.
There I am, right in the center. Look at that.
Look at that. Look at that. That's a
that's a mullet just starting. That's nothing compared to
what I have. That's a baby mullet. Because then we go into this one, the next soccer picture.
Wow. Yeah.
There's a nice. See now.
That one landed. That landed, man. That one. That right hook landed.
My wife always thinks of Kevin as such a nice guy until I went to his apartment in New York City and saw a photo of him putting another man in a headlock and jacking him in the face. I took pictures of it and sent it to Angie and said, still the nice guy you thought?
Well, I wanted to be the guy that you did not want to compete with on the field, but I wanted to be the guy that you wanted to have a beer with afterwards. And I think I really tried to live up to that. But that the story behind that fight, I led the league in fights and penalty minutes, believe it or not.
And this is soccer, not hockey. Same haircuts.
I played soccer for years. It's a very physical game.
Very physical game, and it's bullshit that people say it's not. But
no, it's
my father taught me to fight at a very early age, like really to how to fight, throw hooks and drop your head and.
Well, you're Irish, so
right, you have no choice. And I think
it turned out he was just protecting you from your mother. But anyway,
yeah, exactly. No, from the nuns, Richard. Sister Mary.
Well, Sister, there you go.
Sister there Mary Jo Frazier. All my fight knowledge went out the window.
Yeah. Sister Carmelita used to kick the shit out of me.
But my dad used to say, I went from Catholic school to a public school in Connecticut. My father said, hey, you know, public schools are a little different. So, you know, everything I've been showing you, you know, you know, they're going to take you on right away when you go into that new school. I'm like, what? You know, I hadn't been in any fights in the Catholic school other than dodging the nuns' hooks.
Yeah.
And so my father, you know, he actually said this. It's really amazing. By the way, I'm growing up, like I said, in this white town, lily white town, and not the turn of the century New York like my old man had to live in, you know.
Right.
So he goes, hey, look, somebody's going to give you a hard time. You got to step up right away, because he goes, if you don't step up, they're going to come back the next day and the day after and the day after. And then it's humiliation. Yeah, it's the prison rule. And he goes, so when they step up, he goes, just don't back down. And he goes, if there's a couple of them, he goes, square off with the biggest guy and push him. I go, the biggest guy? He goes, yeah, the biggest guy. You square off with the biggest guy and you push him. And if he throws a punch, you know it's on. And if he doesn't, you know nobody's going to throw a punch, and you know, you can call them pussies and walk out of there. I'm like, okay, interesting. So I walk into this bathroom, maybe the
Did
second
your dad
or third
do
day.
Some time?
No. he fought in the Golden Gloves a little bit too, so unfortunately. So like a different time, like, you know, like I said, growing up in Brooklyn. And so, God, the second or third day of school, I sixth grade, I walk into the bathroom, three guys come in after, you know, and I wound up blowing them all because I didn't want to fight. No.
That's where Richie comes in.
I'm like, hey, I'm not a fighter. No. So I was at the urinal, which, as men know, this is a sacred space. You yes. keep your distance at a urinal. I'm at a urinal, and they pushed me. The littlest guy, believe it or not, pushes me into the urinal. And so I just finish, zip up. And that zipping up takes a while for me because the zipper starts way down low. So I turn around, and here's where I threw them off. I turn around, and I look, and there's three of them standing at me. And they're like, what are you going to do about it? And I don't look at the little guy. I look at the big guy, and I push him. And he throws what my father said he was going to throw. He said, the guy's going to take a step back. And he's going to throw a big roundhouse hook. Right. And he goes, you just get low, block it like I told you, and just hit him in the sternum, and then just follow with another uppercut. And I'm like, okay. And I'd done it a million times, 10,000 hours, you know what I mean, doing this thing. So to push the guy, he stepped way back and took this big, huge swing. And I watched it like it was in slow motion and just blocked it. Hit him in the sternum, and then on an uppercut, he goes down. The other two little guys run out of the room. They're my size. And the big guy's like getting up, like knocked his breath out. He walks out. And I'm like, it had worked. My father, it had worked. I came home. I told my father it was great. You know, he's like, all right, good, good. They'll leave you alone next time. Well, little did my father tell me that he had an older brother. And I swear to God, for the next 3 years, everybody fought the Catholic school kid. I was in like more scraps, getting my ass kicked, winning a few, losing a few, but it's part of the package.
But you know, and what people don't realize in this day and age is that that's part of respect almost. Like, you know, guy, that's what kid guys do. Right. And today it's like we have to have a meeting and the parents have to come in and everyone's got to talk. No, it's just kids being kids.
And I think you got to split the difference maybe. So the story with that fight is earlier in the season, I had gone up for a head ball and I'd headed it away and it was gone. And I was a clean player. I never played dirty ever. Hard and clean. And I headed the ball away. And as I watched it go away in the corner of my eye, I watched the guy come in. He came in 2-3 beats late, headbutted me, split my eye open. I had 36 stitches on my eye.
Whoa.
There. And so I was stitched up and I had to play with stitches. In fact, if you look in that picture again, if you can see over my left eye, there's a bandage. Not that one, the one where I'm fighting. See that left eye?
Oh, yeah. Bandage. I thought you were just pale because you're Irish.
So, well, both. So, though, Bernal, a tribute to this, Irish skin heals really well.
Yes.
So I've got that on it. So I still have stitches up there. And this is the next time we played each other. And I'm bullshit because it was a cheap hit. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to just jack this guy early in the game. I didn't want to get thrown out. We were heading towards the playoffs, and I figured I just wanted to – it's not like hockey where you're allowed to fight. You can't fight. If I got in a fight, I would get thrown out, and I'd get suspended for 2 games, and I'd screw my team over. So as much as I fought, I wanted to fight even more, but you're going to hurt your teammates, so you can't really do that. So I wanted to just drill him once and then walk away like nothing ever had happened. Like you see in, you know, Saga, like, what? No, he's my friend. No, I did nothing. What? I did nothing. So I'm just going to hit him with one shot and then move away and just sort of say like, hey, you know, this is payback. So beginning of the game, like the first shift, because it was indoor soccer, ball comes to me. He comes in like gangbusters. Like he's doing the same thing. He's coming after me, right? Again. So he was there. He was their tough guy. So he comes in, does what we call the 2-foot tackle in soccer. The ball squirts away. As he starts to get up, I'm looking down, I see it's him, and I'm like, oh, this is my chance. Everybody followed the ball, right? So everybody's watching the ball go away. As he stands up, I put him in the headlock. And as he stands up, I wind up with this one punch. I only have one. I know I have just one punch, right? Because I don't want to get caught. So as he starts to stand up, I lean down on him, and just with everything I have, I throw this punch with just all my might. This punch comes flying up, skims off the top of his head, and goes wham, right in my own nose. I fucking rock myself. I broke my own nose under here, and blood gushes out. And now I'm even more pissed, right? Because I know, like, I wake up, I'm kind of in a daze. I almost knocked myself out, for God's sakes, right? So I kind of come out of my daze, and I look down, and he's still in a headlock, right? So I figure, like, oh, my God, the referee's running towards us. I'm like, I don't have any time left, and I've only hurt myself, so I got to, like, unload on this guy. So I just start getting him. That's where when he stood up, I got him, you know, with a hook, and then went in and got him again. And the referee comes over, breaks up the fight. Takes, you know, one look at my nose, throws us both out. The guy goes, the other guy goes, what, I didn't do anything? And the referee goes, yeah, you didn't do anything. And I suppose he gave himself that bloody nose. Get the hell out of here. And so here's the weirdest part of the whole story. I play 3 seasons. I'm out of the league doing stand-up for maybe 3-4 years. All of a sudden, those 2 photos show up in my mailbox at my parents' house. No return address, no anything. Somebody took pictures. Somebody somehow found me, and God bless them. Because I told that story a ton of times, but nobody believed me. Like, you know, no, I really did. I hit myself in the nose.
Kevin, what level of soccer did you get to?
Well, basically, you would have the MISL. Is what you
nice.
New York Arrows, yeah, yeah. So
yeah, that's impressive.
It was the NPSL at that point where MISL and NPSL had gotten together, yeah.
Yeah.
It was 1984, and the league's NASL had folded. That was the only place to play. It was indoor. So I kicked around in Dallas and then Michigan for a while. So it was fun. I wasn't ready to stop playing after college. So it was I really got my yayas out. And I was making the guys laugh, and I started to enjoy that so much that that's where I started to think about stand-up comedy.
Really?
That's awesome. Yeah. So you dive into comedy, and you're hosting TV shows, and then did you know Jackie Flynn from the beginning, or did you guys become friends later?
Richie, do you know Jackie?
Yeah.
All right, so I go to graduate school at BU, and I'm the assistant soccer coach there. I'm the graduate assistant. So I'm going to school in the day. I'm coaching soccer in the afternoon. I'm trying to do stand-up at night. And I start, and I do pretty well right in the beginning. And about a month in, this other guy comes in, and he's totally Guido'd out. You know, he's got the white pants on and the capizios and like a floral shirt. He's got the gold chain around the neck. He says none of that's true, but I remember exactly what he was wearing. And he came up, he did really well. He had a really great, you know, an open micer who does it the first time. He's like, okay, that guy's got something. And I put that
picture up of Jackie and Kevin.
That's who you're gonna out in that photo.
Well, yeah, I was gonna let you.
Well, that's Peter Farrelly, the director, in the middle.
Yeah,
at the next film fest. Yeah, great guy, fantastic guy. But Jackie was—he did really well. And so another thing my father taught me was always go up to people when they do something well and say it, or they do an act of kindness and say it, or they look like they're lonely in a room and need somebody to talk to. So Jackie was none of those. Jackie did well. I wanted to go over and say, "Hey, good job." I go, "Hey, good job, man. You did really well." He goes, "Ah, well, thanks, man. But I'm no pro like you." I'm like, oh, this guy's just a scammer. he's a bullshit artist.
That's funny.
And of course, he's a carny. So he's a carnival worker. So
the two of you do the Brothers from Another Mother tour?
Do the Brothers from Another Mother tour. It's he's West Coast, I'm East Coast. And we started together. And we worked.
And you started in Boston?
We have not done it in Boston yet. Are we going to find the right venue in Boston?
No. Where'd you start?
We started at Lake Tahoe, at the Improv in Lake Tahoe, and we were doing it there for you know, at once a year, and the balance really worked out. You know, I can open or close. Jackie can open or close. I have a whole bunch of jokes about the two of us, and we're going to, you know, we upped it where we sort of show film clips from all the movies, not all the movies we're in, but in the movies that we were in.
Oh, that's cool.
And some of the acting things, and some of the shows that I've hosted, and sort of then we sort of do Q&A at the end, and I basically bust Jackie's balls for 10-15 minutes, then we go off stage.
The club you saw him at, which was probably just an open mic, where was that?
Stitches Comedy Club, Commonwealth Avenue in Boston.
See?
Which is where, which was, man, it was the first time I went on, a month earlier than Jackie, I had a pair of tennis shoes on and no socks, because I'm from Connecticut, that's the rules. And as I walked across the stage for my first stand-up routine, I think it actually helped me in the long run. But as I walked across to go get the mic, I was sweating so much, my sneakers were squishing. So I walked across the stage. I was like, I'm like, oh, my God, I hope people can't hear that. I didn't care if they thought I was funny or not. I just was hoping they didn't hear my shoes squeaking.
Wow.
But Boston, what a time to start in Boston. We were like rock stars in Boston. It was unbelievable.
What year are we talking about? Give us an idea.
Talking about 87 to 90, I was there. And, you know, like I said, in my group.
At the time I started in New York. And I remember you guys coming down from Boston to New York in like the early 90s. And you guys were so fucking good. You know, like it was like every time a guy from Boston came down, I was like, bang, just came in. You had the attitude. You knew that there was something going on in Boston.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting, Richie, that you say that, because a lot of people don't realize, you know, stand-up, it's always like the opener comes out and takes the beach. The feature comes out, tries to make it so hard for the middle for the headliner to follow them. You know, it's like the way it kind of works. In Boston, the stars, they were legitimate stars in the city.
All the hosts.
Steve Sweeney, Lenny Clark, Don Gavin, Kenny Rogerson, Jack Gallagher. These guys would host. So they'd come out and they'd do 45 minutes of killer material.
Brilliant. And nobody else did that, Kevin.
Right.
Nobody did that anywhere but Boston.
Well, they used to say, like, wait a minute. I'm going to make the most money. So I'm going to host because I'm going to be up the most and I'm going to do it. So I'm making the most money. So I'm going first. So the thing is, you had to follow one of these guys. So I remember, you know, you're an open micer. I became one of the funniest open micers, which is really quantifying it there. And then all of a sudden you start to get paid work and you have to open. And right. It's a cold audience.
Right.
It's a cold audience. And you're like, your 20 minutes suddenly turns into seven.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, oh, I have no time left. Well, in Boston, Don Gavin would rip the roof off the place. Yeah. And then you would have to go up after him. Now, he took the beach for you, but you also had to follow it. So that energy, you always see a Boston guy comes up and he's like, hey, how you doing? You know, we start hitting you right away because there's no time. There's no time to go. You know, that old Mike Birbiglia thing came later. It's like, so
what else is
happening? But like in Boston during the day, he would have gotten thrown out of the place,
yeah.
You know? And I tell you, if you didn't do well, you know, Don Gavin was always so sweet, you know, Lenny too. They were great, great mentors to have, not as far as alcohol and drug consumption and paying your taxes, but for the business. But if you couldn't follow Gav, you know, he put his arm around you and go, all right, kid, we'll see you in a couple months. Yeah, come back in a couple months. Yeah, couple of months. If you didn't do well, you didn't come back for a couple of months. So you just had to hit it. And like I said, during my period. About
it. Like Gavin's such a great guy.
Fantastic.
Like he wasn't going, yeah, come back in 6 months. He was saying, no, okay, you know, we'll see you in a couple of months, you know.
Now, he would – you know, come back in 6 months. That's what a booker says to you. And
right.
Not one of us. Look, I've heard David Letterman say this. Stephen Wright said this to me. This is like when someone says they've been a stand-up comic for a long time, we immediately identify with each other because we have all gone through this same trial by fire, this same rite of passage, the same asshole club booker who shorts you $25, the same guy who won't charge you to watch your tape. You know, all the crap that we have had to go through. You know, that's that. But what Gav would say was Gav was a teacher in a former life. And
a coach.
And a coach, right. So, I mean, he was my mentor, him and another guy named George McDonald. So. What's that?
The guy knows basketball.
Oh, yeah, he does. He's making a living off it, betting on it. Yeah. Not right now, obviously. But so you aspire to be as funny as them. And the other thing was there was a lot of work. So I was working 4 or 5 nights a week. And in fact, on the weekends, I'd double up, triple up. You'd come home with $1,000 cash in your pocket. And you stayed in the city and you got good because you stayed in the city. And if you did anything like anybody else, you had some Irish guy going, hey, you know, Dennis Leary does that bit. You'd be like, oh, well, I didn't know. Dennis is doing my bit, I think, is what's happening.
I always felt Boston and New York were pretty much close together as far as comedy goes. Mm. There was that calling out of, hey, that's somebody else's bit. And there was that you got to follow some of the greatest fucking people in the world. I don't think that happens in other cities as much as it happens in Boston and New York.
No, because everybody, most of the time, it's you're insecure. So most people are insecure in a situation like that. You go to a new town, you're kind of feeling it out. Who's a good guy? Who's a bad guy? Who's going to give you a hard time? Do you think I'm funny? And the good comics don't think they're funny all the time. You know, you really don't. That's part of the art form. The humility.
Over the past 20 years, I've noticed in New York City, it's gotten a lot lighter on people blow the light now like it's no big deal. When I was working the door at Stand Up New York, if you blew the light more than one minute, you were getting an earful when you got off stage.
Right.
Now these, you know, club workers are afraid to yell at the comics or afraid to do anything to the comics because the comics will go, yeah, well, screw you. I'm not coming back.
No, don't come back. There's enough
but,
of them.
Yeah, and back then you could say that, but now it's like, I don't know what's going on. It's like I walk in a club and they're like, yeah, we're 20 minutes behind. How are you 20 minutes behind?
Right.
Like that's.
I think those days are over for a while, because
that bullshit. I think
you don't think this isn't going to weed out some of the bullshit and some. Of
I think this coronavirus thing will. I think a lot of people are dropping out, but also look, this. What do they call these kids now? The millennials. They are
Generation Y or millennials.
Generation Y or millennials.
Z. Aren't we on Z?
No. Jesus.
Well, I think. They feel like
how old did we just sound, by the way?
Well, I know, but I mean, look, this is an art form. and you can deviate from the art form, maybe as like a jazz musician deviates from what we're doing. But funny is funny, and it will always be funny. So, you know, I think that whole coffee house thing gave, you know, I think Janine Garofalo started the coffee house stuff because she was trying to compete with these really funny Irish Catholic guys. And she's like, okay, that's, I can't do that. And I think that's genius on her part, where she sort of said, like, I got to go a different route. I think a lot of people who aren't funny try to hide behind something like that.
Right.
Where I finally, you know, I look back on the old tapes of all of us performing. Janine, David Cross, and Louis were not doing as well as I did, but they were doing original material. They were doing really interesting stuff based on their sort of view. And I realize now that they were ahead of the curve. They really were good. They weren't working as much as I was, but...
Our buddy Marshall Childs has the greatest line. Is he said, just because you get a laugh doesn't mean you're funny, and just because you don't get a laugh doesn't mean you're not funny, which I think is so true, because there are comics out there that I watch and I go, that person is a genius, and nothing's really happening. They probably would die on the road. But then you see some guys that are doing the stock material that you know will crush, and it's like they've been doing the same joke for 30 years, 40 years, and you're going, well, no shit, you're gonna get a laugh. You better get one on that bit. You've been doing it for 40 years.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I was working at the Borgata with Gavin.
Oh, really? Lucky you, man. I'd love to.
Oh, what a week, dude.
We yeah, went I bet.
Houses. We had the best time.
He's the best. I know.
He comes down one day, he's got a Starbucks coffee thing full of vodka.
Right.
And he said,
it's usually a water bottle. That's how we get some on the cruise ship.
It was a water bottle. You're right. I'm sorry. It's a water bottle. And he's all pissed off. And I go, what's up? He goes, I went for a physical before I came here. And my doctor just called me. He said that I got to quit drinking. And I go, what are you going to do? He goes, well, the first thing I'm going to do is get rid of my doctor.
Yeah, he hits the sauce, man. But God, I'd love to work at the Borgata with him.
We got to get Gavin on the show, man.
Oh, yes. He's doing the heartbeat. I had him on the other show I do called Best Medicine. Like, it's a Nantucket show, it's hosted by Bob Lee. And we had him on and trying to get him to figure out Zoom technology.
Oh, that's like, true.
It was like throwing that initial typewriter to the monkeys. They're like,
yeah. Well, not only was I at Borgata with him, but it was during the NCAAs. So, what a Flinty! What a great time we had.
Oh yeah, he bets and he knows his games.
And I won a lot of money because I kept calling my bookie going, and he made me a lot of money.
He thought you were on the take somehow. You're getting inside information. You were Don Gavin it.
Yeah, I had Don Gavin, man. He knows his shit, man. Comic. Legend. He's a legend.
Imagine following him. And that's why Boston guys are good, I think. But I was going to say that. But the David Cross, Louis C.K.'s, Janine Garofalo, Mark Maron, Nick Tupolo, all came out of that 1 3-year period. And it's all chronicled on the Comedy Riot. So it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. And, you know, colleges are there. So it's a young crowd. Like, Richie, I feel like New York is a destination place where everybody – you go to L.A. or New York to – begin your career, really.
Yeah. Or
to start the next stage, you know?
LA is different than New York.
Totally. A lot.
You get called out on your bullshit in New York, you know? You know, and Boston definitely calls you out on your bullshit.
Right. Oh, yeah.
They'll fight you.
They'd actually punch you out on your bullshit. Yeah.
So by the time the Boston guys got to New York, they were already called out on the bullshit. So you, like, I remember, like, sitting there watching you, Cotter, everybody, and going, who's this fucking guy? Let me. And then you go, oh shit. Like, you're like, all right, this guy belongs, you know?
But the good thing is the camaraderie was there. Like, I would walk off stage in Boston, and this hasn't happened, you know, much since. I found a few guys in New York and LA, not LA that much at all, like you say, but you'd walk off stage in Boston, and Jackie Flynn, Tom Cotter, Nick DiPaolo, they would all be there, and be like, hey, did you think of this? Try this. I'd be like, oh my God, yeah man. So we'd help each other with our stuff. You walk up to guys in LA at the improv, they're so nervous that you might be above them that they barely look at you sometimes. Everybody's just so insecure.
Yeah. I was never an LA guy, so but that's what I've heard, you know.
It has that feel at the Cellar. You go down there, people are looking over your shoulder. Right. Nobody's talking to you.
Yeah. But again, they're
Yep, I
see. Richie froze.
He had a brain aneurysm.
He had a stroke. Richie had a stroke midway through the show. Oh, so, they axed him. That's entertainment, folks. That's the way it works in Hollywood. You start talking shit
about L.A., you're gone, Richie. So let's real quick. Peter Farrelly was also in that photo. I think it was so funny that Something About Mary's my favorite movie. And then I told you about my obsession with probably second was Outside Providence.
A little known one. Yeah. But that goes much deeper, I think.
And then you told me that it was based off of something that Peter wrote.
No, Outside Providence, yes, was a book that Peter wrote about going to prep school and then coming back and dealing with his local friends and outside in Rhode Island. And he was trying to be a comedy writer and he was living out in L.A. And I think he said he was walking around somewhere. Richie's back.
Who are you talking about?
Talking about Peter Farrelly and this book called Outside Providence, which became a movie. And Pete said he was walking with his brother Bobby, and they got a phone call. So it must have been cell phone days, I think, or you know. So it was a guy named Peter Correnti, who had grown up in Providence, on the hill there, which is the big Italian section in Providence. And he was a movie maker. He had already made a movie. He was this young, ambitious kind of director. And he said, "I love this book. I'm going to make a movie out of it." Pete's like, "Go ahead. You got it," you know, which is typical Pete. And then Pete's career started to take off. And right around the same time, I think after maybe the second of Pete's movies came out, Pete and Bobby's movies came out, this movie Outside Providence came out. And it was, it's a great story. It's a coming of age story.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's so good.
Yeah. You know, and Alec Baldwin's in it and, you know, the conversations that they have around the table, you know, you can't get too big for your buddies because they'll shit on you and shoot you down. You know? So
we call that drinks, jokes, and storytelling.
Exactly. This is 96 shows you guys have done already.
Yeah. And you're a returnee. We had you the first year.
I know. I wonder what number I was.
We're going back in the archives. When we're done, don't come off. Stay on because we want to talk to you about some stuff for our 100th show.
Okay.
But we had, because we haven't talked about it, we're an hour in and we haven't talked about Vic Henley.
Yeah. There he is, man. My buddy. Looking at him, rubbing his belly like a Buddha.
Look at that.
Yeah. Wow. See? Yeah.
Look at that.
You
that
guys was a were night. Tight.
That we were tight. I
Chris Mazzilli on last night, and he talked about Vic. And yeah. So, but guys,
well, that's Chris's club, and we wanted to both work in town. We didn't want to do too much heavy lifting. Let's co-headline, and he's like, great. So we pitched it as North versus South, and we went on that night. And
then you guys have worked less on a I mean, like, hey, I want to hang out with you. At North versus South, seriously.
Win. Call the printer. So it was a fun weekend because we're North versus South, and then on Friday and Saturday night, Gaffigan came in and did a guest spot. So he was So he was the Midwest.
He's from
the Midwest. So he's from Ohio. So we had a really fantastic weekend. But I tell you, look. As I've gotten older, I have a lot of friends, but my good friends are the ones where I don't see them for a year or two. And when I see them, it's not like, why didn't you call me? What did you do? What about me? You know, all that stuff. It's like you pick right up where you were.
In this business.
Yeah, we all have our lives and we all pick up, and I love it. And Vic was a guy who I'd always check in with. You know, I always tell a story. I think I told you on this other podcast you did, Mark. I did a show called Super Dogs, Super Jocks. Yeah. And I was the soccer guy. And I was on with Willie Gault and a couple of linemen, you know, where they were doing these sports activities. And after the show was over, about 10 years after, they took it at ESPN. And the Sklar brothers made fun of certain sports things. So they come up and they grab Super Jocks, Super Dogs, as they should have, you know, because there's so much comedy material there. So they start making fun of me. They start making fun of my hair. They start taking fun, like, where's that dog going? Oh, the dog just found out he's working with Kevin Flynn this weekend, you know, so he's running away. So I'm kind of watching it. I call up Vic. I go, I think I'm going to knock out the Sklar brothers. And he goes, Flynn, you can't do that, man. I go, He goes, you can't beat up those guys. And nobody would – everybody be like, oh, Kevin Flynn beat up – I go, both of them? I go, if I beat them both up, I go –
it's still not like when you knocked out the big guy in the bathroom, bro.
Right. I got a piece of cake. Unless they're into martial arts, take a little longer. We'll have some fun. It'll be popping around. I said, but I'll, he goes, Flynny, man. Flynny, you can't do it, man. You did a TV show. It was shit. They're making fun of it. It was like that homespun Southern, you know, humor. Yeah. I just love it. And I always tell the story about hanging out with him and Greg Rogel and Al Ducharme in the car one day, and I took him to the beach on Nantucket, and we're out all day. We're with my daughter, and you know, being a dad is my number one job. I value it, and I love my friends because they get it. You know, nobody's being inappropriate. But like a little girl is here. I think she's 3 or 4 years old with us. You know, maybe five, four, I think. But we were on the beach, and Rogel was a trip because Rogel kids and Rogel. Oh my God! You know, give me a break. My daughter went over, took him by the hand, and he's like, what's this? You know, and she's like, come on, let's go to the beach. We're going to the beach. He's like, for an hour, my daughter had Rogel at the beach. It softened him up. But at the end of the day, I dropped everybody off, and my daughter said, Dad, do you guys even like each other? And I go, well, I love those guys. They're my great friends. She goes, you're so mean to each other. That's called being a comedian. We're just nasty to him, busting each other's balls all day.
When we got to Nantucket, we got off the boat, and you met us at the boat. And we get off, me, Joel, and Mark, and you're like, wow, you guys haven't missed a meal in a while. I'm like, it's going to be a great weekend.
This is going to be fun.
And it was. We ate.
Oh, it was.
We went to Karen Keelan's, the woman who owns the beachside. She's a great friend and a great person. And I think we stayed there for 5 hours eating and drinking. And I'm like, usually I'm like, I have to get my drunken comedian friends out of somewhere. And she was like, no.
We had it. It was such a great weekend.
We were ready to move in.
I know. We could have. It's just July and August is a problem. That's it.
So hopefully you're not – do you think it's off? Is it off? Or
yeah, it's pretty much off. I'm going to try to do something, but it's off this year. This just, you know, no one wants to go inside a closed building. No one really even wants to go to a place where there's lots of people.
Can you do an outdoor thing, like a one-nighter or a weekend?
Possibly, but even then you're thinking people need to be 6 feet apart. They need to be wearing masks. You know, it's I'm trying to figure it out. And I think the big thing is no one knows. You know, like, again, to go back to Jackie Flynn, he calls me like every other day and is like, what do you think? What do you think about July? I'm like, scientists don't know. And you're asking me, you know,
Fauci doesn't know.
And Trump certainly doesn't know. So I'll tell you that right now.
My favorite, somebody sent me a meme. It said like all these scientists, doctors, health physicians, you know, all these people. Said that the virus is very dangerous, but a couple of my buddies from high school who barely passed science said it's not dangerous. Yeah. So I don't know who to believe anymore.
He's got no shirt and an AK-47 in his hands. Yeah.
Plenty. You do anything this summer, you need anything from us, you know, you got it.
You guys are the best, man. You guys are always working, and that really says a lot because you're passionate about what you do, but also people need to laugh right now more than ever. And the returns aren't always great on some of this stuff, but we do it for those where it hits and it lands, you know?
Yeah.
And
Kevin, we definitely got to have you back on the for our 100th episode.
100th episode, yeah.
We have a fun show.
Lined up, idea. Do you?
Yeah, so we'll cut out here because we're an hour 8 in. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.
Last call.
Thanks for listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.